Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, chair of the club's Grown-Ups Forum, and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Barbara Rose Brooker. Barbara's a native of San Francisco. She has a Master's of Arts in Creative Writing from San Francisco State University and teaches writing at State as well as the OLLI, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. She speaks on national television on ageism and creativity. And if there were anybody that personifies anti-ageism, it's Barbara Rose Brooker. Please join me in welcoming Barbara.
Thank you so much. First of all, thank you, John, who's never said no to me. He's had me here many times for programs, and I'm always so honored to say, I'm speaking at the Commonwealth Club, and they go, wow. Thank you, John. And thank you all for coming out in the rain tonight. Oh, my God, you're forever on my good list. You really are. To think you came out in that rain, I'm not so sure I would do it. So, I'm going to wing it tonight, but before I start, I want to dedicate this program tonight to my brother, who passed away a few days ago, to Robbie. He was very supportive of my work, and we often talked about the Jewish American princess can be a man too, because it's not about being Jewish, it's every culture, and it's for men and women. It's about attitude. I was programmed. The reason I'm so passionate about this subject is I was programmed to define myself by a man. And there's nothing wrong with having a man. There's nothing wrong with being married. I think that's all wonderful. I'm not against any of that. But it was very painful to feel, to have that lost self within me. And I think so many women and men are taught to define themselves either by money or power or by a partner. And for me, the Jewish princess is the opposite of that. It's power, it's attitude, power within the self. Now, that all sounds very, like, iffy, and you're probably thinking, well, what does she know about that? Okay, I'm going to tell you at least my perspective. First of all, I watch a lot of late night TV. I you know, live alone, and I've got the clicker and the TVs in every room. And I watch late night TV, and very often I hear the Jewish princess joke. And I can't stand that. To me, it's demeaning for all women. I don't think it's funny. You know, oh, she's, you know, her favorite position is looking at Bloomingdale's or shopping. It's so demeaning, and I think we have to do better than that. To me, that's like saying that's racism, it's police brutality, it's homophobia, and I think we have to stop that. I really want to stop that Jewish American princess joke. Okay. So, mine, you know, there's the old Jewish princess and there's the new Jewish princess. I'm kind of I was neither, by the way. I was just programmed to be one. And I've kind of crossed some generations, and that's the point. I don't believe in age. I think ageism is a major disease in our country, but that's not what I'm going to talk about tonight. And you may say, well, maybe she doesn't believe in age because she's 78. You know, the older we get, the more we can do. And the more we learn and the more purpose we have. So I don't believe in age. So let me just start by telling you why I wrote The Rise and Fall of a Jewish American Princess. Why that title, The Rise and the Fall, and then Who Is She? And it really started when I had dreams, and we can all have dreams, whether we're 78 or 16 or 92, and a lot of the dreams are tucked in our drawers behind our pantyhose, and we say, oh, we're going to take the dreams out when this happens and that happens and this happens. And I think the dreams are so important at any age. So I had a dream, oddly enough, to be doing what I'm doing today. But back then, in the 50s, oh my God, that repressed era with the poodle dog skirts. And then when I was married, and you'll have to read the book to find out all the dirt, but when I was married, very unhappily, hating the suburbs, I mean, I didn't know who I was. I hated it. I just knew this life is not for me. And I was dreaming about writing books and painting and doing all these things and going to college. But I had been programmed to be a dummy, you know, or marry a rich man. Don't let me trip on this, Olivia. There's a thing there. So I was unhappy, and I had this dream, and I had two wonderful daughters who are here tonight. One's from LA, one's from Berkeley. Raise your hands, you wonderful daughters. They're fabulous daughters. Okay. Because they learned the hard way by being with me, a mother who wasn't traditional, who went through marriages, various things, and boy, they learned, and they're fabulous. Okay, so without getting into all of that, I started taking notes about the rise and fall of a Jewish American princess in the 70s. And I won't tell you the whole story, but I had had a brutal, brutal psychological rejection and horrible thing happened to me when I was 19. I won't tell you what it is because you'll read it in the book. And I thought, I can never get over this. So I was kind of hiding in the suburbs and in a marriage that I didn't care about. But I took notes. And I kept my journals hidden in the pantyhose, in the handkerchief boxes and so forth, and blah, 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 and dreamed of going to college. I'm going to fast forward. So 10 years later, when I got divorced and I had these two little girls, and I had no education, no money. Well, still a struggle with the money in this business. But I really had nothing. And no support whatsoever from the father. You know, the whole story. The whole story. And I'm not here to trash him either. But this is a story of many, many women. So anyway, to make a long story shorter, I then, in the divorce, went to San Francisco, got a job in a bank, which I hated more than life itself, and had the two little girls and was dreaming of going to college. Okay, I'm going to fast forward a little bit. I got very interested in the contemporary art market, and I started working in galleries and so forth. So, I don't know how it happened, but I did go to college, and I started at San Francisco City College. Now, can you imagine, we're talking, was it the 60s or early 70s? But, you know, I was like 32, 34 years old, and I had to wear a tag that said re-entry woman on a Velcro name tag. I mean, I was considered old. It was almost like embarrassing. They had to put me aside, and it was hard. It was hard because I hadn't been used to studying and so forth. And I was thinking of all kinds of things, PhDs, maybe medical school. I mean, everything I was thinking of. But I was very, very involved very quickly in literature and writing. Very quickly. But I had 3 years at San Francisco City College because I was dragging on the streetcars back and forth, and I had the children and the jobs and the whole thing. But I really wanted to find that self that we all talk about. It sounds so, you know, but it really does exist, or selves. And I started therapy and the whole thing. Okay, So I got to San Francisco State University. Is Andrea here yet? No, she's not here. Okay. She now runs San Francisco State. I got to State, and I transferred, and I majored in English literature. I was going to go for a PhD in English literature, but I started writing The Rise and Fall of a Jewish American Princess. And one day, I forget what his name was, Mira, who's a wonderful writer, playwright, and works at State, Jess Ritter, he wrote me a note, and he said, this book must be published. I had to enter the book as my thesis to get into graduate school. Grad school then was a lot different than it is now. You had to have a full, complete work and orals and the whole thing. So I entered the book, and I think it was Leo Litvak, and he said, this book has to be published. It is incredible. It's like 500 pages, all those typewritten pages, no computers then. And so I floated home. I saved his notes. I still have the notes to remind me when I get down, because there's been so many books since then, and it is a very hard field. So anyway, make a longer story shorter. I entered the book as my thesis, and another professor said, you must get an agent. This book has to get out there. So he sent me to Fred Hill, who has died, and was a very famous literary agent. And Fred said, oh, my God, it's a movie. Oh, my God, I love this book. And I just can't believe, because I didn't have the self yet. The self hadn't quite formed. And I wasn't in connection with it. I was more like doing things on the outside, and then I had this little inside private world. So anyway, Fred sold the book. I think I had it 2 years left of grad school, and he sold the book to Random House, and I got a $10,000 advance. Now, you know, in 78 or whatever that was a lot of money. And I Xeroxed that check, and I still have it framed. And I was like, oh, my God, this is fabulous. Oh, my God, I'm going to be the next Erica Jong. And oh, my God. And all this is going on. And to make a long story short, they flew me to New York. I met my editor. She was horrible. Mean bitch. But that's very much the nature of the business, too. But because I didn't have that full-blown self, like, where I really believed in myself, I thought, well, she must know what she's talking about, so I better do what she says. So she said, I want to change the point of view. I don't want it first person. I want it third person, and this and that, and this scene needs to go, and this scene needs to go. So I come home, and I do it all, thinking, she knows. A year later, they canned the book because the voice was gone. The self was gone. I hadn't been true to myself and my own voice. And that is the basic law of originality, creativity, uniqueness, being who you are, is to be true to your own voice, your own feelings, and not listen to what other people say. Well, I was devastated, as you can imagine. I had put all my dreams in this book. Everything in this book. I put it on the shelf. And I wrote another novel called So Long, Princess, about this experience of rise and fall. That sold to William Morrow. Because in those days, they didn't have self-publishers and things like that. It was very, very, very hard to get a book published. So I was all excited, and that did pretty well, actually. And then I went on and I wrote several other books, but the bestseller never came. I had had dreams then. Bestseller. I don't care now. I just love the process. But here's the moral of the Jewish princess, what I was going to say. So, the Jewish princess story in 1980-something, I don't remember, 1991 or 1992, I pulled it out. I had a dream one night, and it said, go get that original book and get it off the shelf and get it out there. And I ran to my shelf, and my pages were all yellow, and it was all typed on my Smith Corona. By then, I've been on a computer, of course. I'm a tech moron, but I still have to work on a computer. And all this, and I thought, geez, pages were missing, and I, like, taped them together, and some pages said, just like Ted Hughes did to Sylvia Plath, for those of you who are familiar with Sylvia Plath's work and what Ted Hughes did to her, he would put omission. I had omission, page missing, this missing. And because there was self-publishing then, I said, I'm going to self-publish a few of them and see how they look. And I put a few out there. Toby bought one. You have one of the original ones. Then I pulled it away because it wasn't developed enough for me. And I put it away for a while, and I went on to write the Viagra Diaries, which, by the way, for those of you who is curious, I will brag. It's been 3 years, but the option is still going, and the script was just finished, and it's moving forward, and I'm still very excited about it. And then Should I Sleep in His Dead Wife's Bed is another one that Susie is representing wherever she is. I don't see. Oh, there you are. You have the hat on. Okay. So I was writing these funny books. They still took 2 years to write, but you know, I hadn't quite reached that deepest self to write The Rise and Fall of a Jewish American Princess. And before I leave the planet, I said, I want to write the true story. I want to write that one book that resonates with me. I don't care that it's taken a lifetime or what. So I started tearing it apart about 2 years ago. Tearing it apart, and I got it together, and it's out now. And I have to say, oh, hi, out in the rain. Oh, I know. Oh, God bless you. Oh, my God, in the rain. So I am so thrilled because the buzz on this book, I don't know what's going to happen. Does it matter? But the buzz on the book has been so spectacular. I'm getting emails from all around the country, and it's really going on word of mouth because I don't have the big publicist and the promotion. I'm very lucky that John, are you here, that John has me at the Commonwealth Club. I've had a few book signings. But it's getting around, and I'm getting letters from women all around the country and men too because it is about the rise, which is expectations. We're often all raised on expectations. And those expectations are like the rainbow. They keep us going. But then when they fall, then you fall. And then you reconstruct yourself. So to me, it's the rise and the fall and the rise. And there might be another fall in the rise. And it's for, as I say, men and women. So that's where the title comes from, The Rise and Fall of a Jewish American Princess. And the one thing in my teaching, I love teaching so much, and the one thing, and I see miracles all the time, is I try to get across, I'm not really a good copy editor, and I don't really care about, you know, all the details, but to get the voice out there, and there's very few who make the voice. And to me, it's very, very important. And so I think I'm rising. I'm not sure. I'm definitely getting older. But I have other books I'm working on right now, and I can't wait to work on my poetry manuscript and to get back to a lot of manuscripts that I had put aside for commercial reasons, really. Because the Viagra Diaries did bring me very good money for 2 years, and that was fun. So now I just want to do the books that I want to do. And, oh, my God, I can't. Oh, my. God bless you. Oh, that's okay, Beatrice. Thank you for coming. Oh, my God. Anybody who comes out in this weather, let me just tell you one quick thing. I had a major trauma in my apartment a year ago, and I renovated my whole apartment from top to bottom. It's gorgeous now, on my Simon & Schuster money from the Viagra Diaries, and I had nowhere to stay. And this lady, Beatrice, came up to me at a book signing for the Viagra Diaries and said, I'm a block away, and I have an extra room and bath. And I moved in for months. Oh, my God. Well, the motto, I don't want to bore you and start being so narcissistic, is to go on about myself, myself, myself. But I am excited about these books, and I'm very excited about seeing all of you, and the message is be true to yourself, and anything is possible at any age. And thank you for listening.
We'd like to remind our listening audience this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Barbara Rose Booker, author extraordinaire.
Thank you.
Barbara, I know you'll take questions.
Oh, I love
So could we have questions from the audience
now?
We have a mic so you can be heard. Here. We'll pass the mic so you can be heard on the...
I love the questions.
There.
Do you know who Betty Loesch is?
Pardon me?
Betty Loesch. Do you know Betty Loesch?
Yes.
Yeah, you signed something very beautiful in her book. You're related to her some way, no?
I don't remember.
She just turned 104.
Betty!
Betty!
Oh, my God, she's related to my father.
Yes.
My father died at 60, and she's 104.
That's right. And she's a very good friend of my family.
Linda, my cousin.
And Linda's the one that was supposed to be here today. She doesn't feel good.
I know. I had a lot of calls from people who,
yeah.
I didn't blame them at all.
So this is how it all started. I went to Betty's 104th birthday party. Your book was sitting next to her nightstand.
Serious?
I said, can I borrow this?
Are you serious?
And that's how it all got started.
She's reading at 104.
She's doing more than reading.
And she's beautiful. And
she's amazing.
Wear glasses.
She is amazing. I have pictures of her.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. Okay. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Thank you for telling me that.
Yeah.
I need to go see.
I have pictures of her for you to see after.
Love to see.
Hesitate to ask any questions because the mic is powerful. Here she goes.
My question is, since I miss, I'm sorry, maybe you have said it already. Why did you choose to write that story over others? What prompted you?
That's a really good question. Thank you for asking it, because I knew it had the truth, and it had the truth that I hadn't wanted to face so much of it. It was so painful. And I was finally able to put it together into a narrative and to develop the storyline like I had never had. But that's the answer. I finally was able to face the truth. And I'm constantly digging my well because I'm on another project and you have to keep digging for the truth. Thank you. Everything's an autobiography. Every author, I say, you know, a lot of people ask me that. Is it true? Did it happen? And I'd like to talk to an author where they made it up, unless you're Stephen King or you're doing a certain kind of genre. A lot of it is, yes. You can ask me what. Yes. Oh, is there somebody else who wants to ask me anything? I'll tell. I've been writing poetry since the 70s. And I have published poetry. My biggest claim to fame is I have a poem in an anthology with Maya Angelou. And I've been working on a manuscript. In fact, Mira and myself and other poets were together for many years working together on our projects. I'd love to get back to it. I really want to work on this poetry manuscript, but I have to make some money meanwhile.
Hi. I think I'm an American Jewish prince, but yeah. I'm not sure. My wife says I am. What exactly, I mean, we sort of have an idea about the American.
What it is, you mean?
Yes.
You have all the trappings of a Jewish American prince. You're handsome and you live very well. You have a beautiful wife and, you know, all those sorts of things. But I don't really know you, but from what I've heard, you're not really the Jewish American prince because you're like a real person. I think the Jewish American... See, the Jewish American prince thing is for every culture and every religion and everything. It's an attitude. I mean, I think it was the Jay Leno show last year. I was appalled. I was watching it, and he was so stupid. And he was making all these Jewish American prince and princess jokes and then going, you know, and like lightweights. It's an attitude, and I think it has to do a lot with money and shopping. Yeah, yeah.
Hi. I'd like to talk about Jewish American princess. I've known Barbara many, many years, and we've had a somewhat parallel life in that we've had divorce, we had two children, single mother.
We lived in the suburbs.
Lived in the suburbs and on and on and on. And being involved in the single scene, the title Jewish American Princess, or the stigma of Jewish American Princess, mm-hmm. seems to be attached to us. It's like what we have to do is try to overcome that terrible, you know what? It's a joke among Jewish men.
Well, I don't want to.
Which
be with
I think
those
is.
They're so, idiots. I mean,
well, you know what? You can call them idiots. You can call them whatever. The reality is that when they find out that you're Jewish, and the ironic thing is, they're more comfortable being with a Jewish American woman because that's who their mother was.
Or it makes them feel omnipotent. You know, it makes them feel good because they're identifying with things,
yeah.
with assets and things, because women nowadays have so many voices and ways to go. By the way, I'm not saying that a woman has to you know, have a fabulous career and make $1 billion. That's all wonderful, but that's not what it's about. It's more an attitude. And those men you're talking about, I know who those men are. I choose not to be with them at all because they really are emotional, psychological idiots. They're really not with this generation, and they're old. That's so old. I think that what has to happen is, just like if I hear a racist joke or I hear a homophobic joke or anything, I voice what I feel and stop it, and I don't want to be with that person. And it's the same thing with the, quote, Jap joke. They think it's so funny, Jewish American prince, Jewish American princess. And I think as women moving into new generations, like I adore Gloria Steinem. She is one of my favorites because she's constantly inventing and reinventing, and it's so much about purpose. It's not about what you wear or what you own or what you have or what they have. So much. And I think as women, and I'm looking at different ages here and professional women here, there's fabulous professional women here who are young, like Patricia and Olivia and people who are doing fabulous things, but they could still be a Jewish American princess in their attitude. They're not, but what I'm saying, it's an attitude, and I think it has to stop. It really does. It has to stop. I really hate it, and I hate those kinds of jokes. I don't know if I answered your question. Yes. Jewish American workhorse. Whatever. But I think that we're going into a new time, a new generation, and it's not just about our degrees and our books and our things that we do. It's really inside. It's inside. Like I noticed at Ollie when I was there that so many women coming to class now are in their 80s and 90s, and men too. And I never think, oh my God, she's 85 and he's 96. because they're young and they have purpose and they have wisdom and they're developing, they're writing books or they're doing whatever they want. There's so many ways to reinvent oneself. Listen, I'm struggling with the same things because the year is ending. And I write a column called Boomer in the City for the J Weekly. I've had it for years, for those of you who read my column. So the new column will be out this week. And they said, we want a title for the end of the year. And it's called Anything is Possible at Any Age. And I know it sounds a little, you know, but I really believe that. Now I'm trying to think, what am I going to do with my life now? I have to reinvent next year. But it's so much fun ending it with you.
We're fighting for the mic. There was a woman in a previous Commonwealth Grown-Ups Forum group who started playing the cello when she was, like, I don't know, mid-60s.
Yeah.
And she said something that really struck me, and you reiterated it here, and that was that this time she was learning to play the cello just simply because she enjoyed it. She had no aspirations of ever becoming famous.
That's right.
She had no aspirations of performing. It gave her such great joy. And I think she was saying what you just said, mm-hmm. that she had come into her own. And I love that.
I love that because it's. I always think we're like a musical instrument. Our soul is like a musical instrument. And there's many different keys to play. And that's wonderful. There's so many things to do. It isn't one thing. Yes.
Barbara, I'm sorry. I have the mic, though.
No, go ahead.
But we'll get right to you. You've been a champion against ageism. And I've always believed that age is a very poor metric because it really has to do with a person's functional ability, which can last far beyond their age markings.
This is true.
And I just appreciate that and wonder if you'd say something about...
Yes, because I know you work with aging and ageism. So let me just say one more thing. I'm sorry to do I again. But I'm the founder of the first age march, AGE, in history. I've given 3 so far. A 4th one is going to be next May, and hopefully it's going to go to Washington. We're trying to get much bigger funding right now. It's been very hard in starting this grassroots movement. So what John just addressed is true. You know, I do get the question, well, you know, I'm in a nursing home. My brother was in a nursing home, and he was only in his 60s. But he was unable to do a lot of things I'm talking about. But I also watched him through years of pain and procedures and horrible things as I watched other people at different ages in their minds, how they... There's a woman at the nursing home who's 107, she's this lovely woman, and every time I'd go see my brother and have lunch with him downstairs, she would be there. And she was amazing, and she said she was keeping a diary. And she was talking into a tape recorder because she wanted this diary to be the story of her life. And so I think that people, no matter what the mind and the soul are so separate from the body, and we don't even know yet where it can take us or they can take us. I don't know if I answered John's question. It's a big question. Yes.
Barbara, in addition to all the other things you do, you are an artist, and I'm wondering if whether your art is inspired by this confidence in aging.
Thank you. You know, it's really interesting. I put away my paintings the past 5 years or 4 years because not only were the canvases large, but I was ruining my apartment, and it was a mess. So when I had the apartment redone, it's very minimal and dove gray with white trim. I mean, it's so minimal. And I thought, I feel very inspired these days. So I started on small sheets of canvas paper. And I'm building them up. I have about 40 of them right now. And I'm building them up, and I'm noticing, yes, I feel very inspired. My line is very loose now. I don't care what anyone thinks. I'm doing what I want. And I'm just piling them up on a chair. And hopefully I'm going to bring them into some triptychs or something down the line. Thank you for asking, Barbara.
Oh. Yeah, I'm sorry we were late because we really were looking forward to this. But I didn't hear if you addressed this at all. But in this, what I call the new birth, was there any mention of the grieving process, whether that be your own personality or through loved ones? Because as we age, we obviously experience that. And has that had any effect on you?
Well, you know, as I said, I lost my brother this Wednesday. And I had been with him that whole few days in the coronary care unit when he was on all the machines and everything. He had been very, very ill. So I've seen it over a period of years, and I'm still numb from it. But where I am right now from it is what amazed me is the nurses would say, oh, he can't hear you. You know, he had the breathing tube and the machines and the dialysis and this. And he can't hear you. And I would say, Robbie, it's Barbara. And I love you so much. And if you can hear me and you know I'm here, squeeze my hand or blink. Well, he couldn't squeeze my hand, but he blinked. So I guess I keep remembering that blink because the mind just stays alive. And then one other thing. I was with him the whole time, and the one time I went home to change my clothes and the one time I went home, 20 minutes later, I got a call from the doctor that he had passed on. So when I went back to see him, what was so amazing is his soul had gone somewhere else. It was just a body there. It was just a body. I think we make so much in our society about bodies and deaths and funerals and this, but it goes somewhere else. And this has really inspired me. Yeah, I'm in the stage right now where I'm very sad and I wake up at 4 a.m. with it, you know, but I think in time that will. Right now I'm just trying to make arrangements and do things that are right for him. Oh. Uh-huh. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, 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 yes. You know, I'm reading this book now by Janet Malcolm. Is anyone here familiar with Janet Malcolm? Are you Mira? She's an incredible critic, a literary critic. And she writes books on... Anyway, I'm reading... And she quotes that she needed, that it was the trauma and the trauma of her life that inspired her so to write. You know, I used to say the pain and the things that don't work out and everything, I just pretend they're in a box. And then I use them for language or to sort out, to develop plots. I don't know if I answered your question. I don't think I did. I think it's a big question.
You know the Philip Roth line, nothing bad can happen to a writer, everything is material. Material.
Oh, yeah, Philip Roth said that. Yeah. Well, I believe that this is true, but everyone doesn't believe that, and everyone doesn't need pain to write, but, you know, I do believe. You know, like I've had people say to me, oh, you've had such a hard life. It was so hard doing this. And I said, it was? It wasn't to me. I love what I'm doing. And the harder life gets, it's another novel. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. Yes. We appreciate your talk tonight. Barbara's the author of The Rise and Fall of a Jewish American Princess, as well as an anthology on life. We thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And before we close, We have a special award for you, Barbara. Candice, would you please come up here? Yes. A magic wand for a Jewish American princess. All right. And now this meeting, before I close the meeting, Barbara, will you be available in the lobby to sign books? Okay. So don't stay up here and answer questions. Go on out there and get. You've earned it. You so deserve it. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 111th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.